Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Plains on the Prairie podcast. I'm Max.
And I'm Sam.
And we are on our third episode of the Minnesota Aces series.
Yeah, it's gone by quick.
Yeah, we are, pun intended, we are flying through these guys.
Good one.
Yeah. So this one is actually our first Marine Corps ace, not just of the North Dakota and, well, excuse me, not just of the Minnesota series, but from our previous North Dakota one as well.
Right, yeah, it's little, as we know, Minnesota, more population, but way more diverse group here.
Absolutely.
It's going to be a fun series.
Absolutely. So without further ado, we'll just hop right in. So we will be covering the life and career of Cecil J. Doyle. And he was born on August 10th, 1920 in Marshall, Minnesota. And during high school, worked as a lifeguard, kind of interestingly. Didn't know if it was probably at a public pool or maybe a river or a lake down there. But he attended Marshall High School and graduated either in 1937 or 1938. I think we should just mention right now that we unfortunately could not find a whole lot of information on Cecil's life and career.
Right. There's, I actually found this guy by accident reading Joe Foss's autobiography. You might hear us touch a base on that book a little bit. It's called A Proud American. And it does mention him about five or six different times throughout the book and has a little bit, it's more on his combat side of things. Mm-hmm. But
and Joe Foss was from the Sioux Falls, South Dakota area.
Yep. So I guess if we ever do a South Dakota series, right. he will be in
he
there.
He will be for sure. But I was just going to say, Marshall and Sioux Falls,
they're not far apart.
They're not far.
No.
I mean, maybe in the 1930s, maybe.
Yeah.
But in today's geography and
two-hour drive?
Yeah, yeah, something like that. So kind of cool, same area, and you know, you go how many thousands of miles away, and you have a South Dakota and a southern Minnesotan guy
right.
fighting almost alongside one another. So, and then after Cecil graduated either in 1937 or 1938, he attended the State Teachers College in Mankato, Minnesota. From there, we enter his military service, and he enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps on March 26, 1941. So, probably like a lot of our aces, early aces, saw the writing on the wall, saw that, you know, war was brewing.
Yeah, and it did say in one source that he was somewhat interested in flying, so he figured the Navy or Marine Corps would provide a good avenue to get into aviation. War clouds were looming, of course, but,
absolutely,
but wasn't inevitable at that point. Mm-hmm. So,
following his training, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant with the United States Marines on April 6th, 1942, and was assigned to VMF or Marine Fighter Squadron 121 at Henderson Field in Guadalcanal on October 9th, 1942. So obviously he had been in training or in the Marine Corps at the time of Pearl Harbor, you know, was called up, went through combat training, all that fun stuff, and was eventually posted to Guadalcanal in October of 1942. Now, Sam, I know you've been doing a ton of reading on Guadalcanal and the air war above it, me included in this group, but for those that might not be super caught up with the air war over Guadalcanal, would you mind talking to us a little bit about, you know, what it entailed, what it would have been like to have been a pilot at that time?
Yeah, so just on a kind of a broader macro scale of everything, Guadalcanal was one of the first stepping stones in the island hopping campaign of the Pacific, which was the kind of strategy to hit the very important islands and kind of bypass some of the others. Guadalcanal was a hotly contested island in the southern Pacific where we're looking at, okay, that it's pretty much the doorstep of Australia at this point. So we had, New Britain with Rabaul and some other places overrun by the Japanese in early 1942. The war was not looking good for the Allies in the Pacific. To provide some context and time, we had Coral Sea already where, you know, the U.S. started gaining confidence in combat, kind of learning about what the Zero does in combat. That'll come in later here. And Midway was already done. So the next step was to move on from Australia and move up and start the island hopping. So Guadalcanal is a small island, and on it there is a specific field called Henderson Field. You may have heard of it, codenamed Cactus. So what happened was we had a small bastion of aircraft land there from carriers, various carriers, and formed what was called the Cactus Air Force. The Cactus Air Force was a very ragtag group with various, I would almost call it a composite squadron of squadrons. We had Marine squadrons, we had Navy squadrons, and we had U.S. Army Air Force squadrons of different different aircraft types. You had P-400s, P-39s, Wildcats, Dauntlesses, Avengers. You kind of had the whole works there of everything. And by the time Doyle showed up with VMF 121 in October, the battle was already 2 months old. The raids on Guadalcanal to initially strike against the Japanese who built the field happened in early August. And by now, in October, the fight to hold the field was very much there. They were holding the line. The front lines were literally less than a mile from the field.
And Guadalcanal was where, you know, famous icon of the Marine Corps, John Vassalone, earned his mm-hmm. Medal of Honor. Was he defending the perimeter to the airfield?
At times.
Wow, that is unbelievable. You know, so often, and especially when you think in Europe in World War II, there was never, especially for the Army Air Force in England, there was never a threat of, you know, an engagement by the enemy at that home field. I don't even think when they crossed the channel into France after D-Day, was there ever the threat of a German invasion hitting an airfield there.
This was about as forward of an air base as you can get.
Absolutely.
And, you know, everybody was just, health was an issue. We talked about this with Register last fall when we covered our North Dakota Aces series. He was in very ill health through combat. He was malnourished. He was very sickly. You were just right on the front lines, and you didn't know if you were going to be part of the ground fighting.
Right.
So VMF 121 came over in October, and that was only 8 pilots, including Joe Foss. And then another pilot that we'll talk a little bit about is Caller C. Brandon. He was a Grand Rapids, Minnesota native, so northern Minnesota. And they were best buddies, Doyle and him. So there was a group of 8. And, you know, they had some success. They were called Joe Foss's Flying Circus. And Joe Foss is very famous. I think he had over 20 kills in the war, a lot of them coming from mm-hmm. Guadalcanal.
So did the amount of kills come from just superior tactics, or were the Japanese pilots ill-trained, or did they just not expect American resolve to be as strong as it was?
A lot of historians say Guadalcanal was one of the last great air combat, for lack of better terms, air battles of the Pacific.
Between
the Japanese and the U.S.
Very strong Air Force. So
the Japanese quality of pilots was super high in the early Pacific War stages because you had all this time fighting in China and in the South Pacific. You know, you still had people coming from Malaya fighting the British and Burma. But during Guadalcanal, you did start to see the attrition. Looking at the loss records of the first couple months of Guadalcanal, it was pretty split, but at the same time, the tactics, which I know we've discussed before, the tactics between the two nations was Japan wanted to put its best troops out there. It's like a football team. Mm-hmm. You're putting your Tom Brady's and your Peyton Manning's out there all the time because they're the best. They want to win now.
Right.
Whereas the U.S. was, okay, we're going to bring these pilots from, let's say, Midway, who fought in Midway. Let's bring them back home and teach these new recruits how to fight so then we can produce more in the long game. So after Guadalcanal, the Japanese started to see that catch up. All of their China veterans, all of their Pearl Harbor veterans from the Navy, because a lot of the units, 99% of the units early on in Guadalcanal were naval units. You started to see a shift in that September-October timeframe to some Army units.
Mm-hmm.
But
and the Army units were based at Rabaul, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And the Navy ones were too. A lot of the ground-based ones.
They didn't have any aircraft coming from some of the carriers?
Originally they did, but then Midway kind of shook them too. So they were their tactics on using the carriers were a little more cautious.
Gotcha.
But a lot of these missions flown by the fighter squadrons, such as VMF 121, were escort missions for the Dauntlesses, the Avengers, and the Air Cobras for ground interdiction, and also for going after what was called the Tokyo Express. So the Tokyo Express was just a supply run for all the Japanese troops, and they'd come every night.
They were running a gauntlet.
A gauntlet, they? Yes. Yeah. And also against Bettys. Bettys were constant over the airfield. They weren't the most accurate bombers, but it was more of a psych factor for everybody.
I remember reading that, well, I guess this was more the Japanese naval bombardment after they drove off the task force that had been assigned to help, you know, cover the Marine Corps landings. But that was, I think, the first and or the last time that U.S. Marine or U.S. military units have actually been shelled from Japanese or enemy ships.
Right.
And I think at least the video, or the source that I watched said that that was a lasting impact for those Marines and sailors that were, and Army can't.
No.
Quick shout out, the 164th Infantry Regiment of the North Dakota Army National Guard was the first Army unit anywhere in the United States or during World War II to see offensive action against the enemy.
Right.
Which is super cool for us. I'd say if we weren't an aviation-focused podcast, we could talk about them for an episode, but who knows? Maybe we can one day.
Maybe. Yeah. So there's just a little context on Guadalcanal for you guys, especially the early stages. So high attrition at this point on the broad scale. Health was deteriorating, deteriorating not only among the infantry, but the pilots as well, because they were right there with them.
So going back to Cecil, he had all of his victories. Did we say it was about, did we have a specific number? Was it obviously more than five?
He had five. He did. Exactly. Okay.
And he scored all of them between October 18th through the 25th of 1942. So we're coming up on what?
72 years ago.
72 years. Sir, forgive
this,
my math.
This, so if you guys are catching this on some, you'll catch this as we release the podcast. We're going to try to theme some of our aces around the time of year we're releasing it. So you'll notice that here coming up on the next few for sure.
Yeah.
So just little Easter eggs, if we want to call them that.
Absolutely. Think about what aircraft you would most commonly associate with Halloween.
There we go.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So we've been trying, again, Sam and I have been working very hard on researching Cecil's military career, and you know, like we had said, the Cactus Air Force was a ragtag group. Like, they were recording kills, but it wasn't, you know,
it was usually
by
personal
the
accounts.
Exactly.
Yeah, like Joe Foss has a lot of his said in there, but I don't know how much time you spent, but I spent a good 4 or 5 hours at least trying to just track down the kills. I reached out to some authors, unfortunately didn't get hear back from them, which is fine. I didn't really expect a quick response, but couldn't find anything.
Absolutely. So on November 7th, 1942, maybe we should probably talk about the events leading up to this. So
yeah,
we had mentioned earlier in the episode Kohler.
Yeah.
Kohler C. Brandon, the Grand Rapids, Minnesota native, was shot down and killed on October 14th. And obviously, Doyle. It's probably safe to assume that Doyle and Brandon were really close.
They were really close. So there's an excerpt out of the book where they were called the Foolish Twins, both Doyle and Brandon. And I've seen conflicting on which one's Fool and which one's Ish, but they had the nicknames Fool and Ish as their call signs. So they were very tight, very tight,
very close. Yeah, unfortunately, Brandon was shot down and killed, and from the accounts in the book, what book was that again?
A Proud American by Joe Foss.
American, thank you. It was said that Doyle was extremely more vengeful.
Yeah, like, Foss grounded him for many missions. The timelines were kind of being a little goofy here, but from what my understanding is, he grounded him for a few missions, and then he got all these kills and was flying a little recklessly, and he eventually paid most likely with his life.
Yeah. It said that on November 7th, 1942, he was declared missing in action after ramming a Japanese plane in midair. So
And he was seen going down with one wing in two different books that I've cross-referenced.
Gotcha. So he was declared MIA, but in Proud American, it's presumed that he was killed in that crash. And as far as I'm aware, I don't think they've ever recovered remains.
I haven't seen anything, and I looked up on Pacific Rex.
Was it over? Did they know if it was over water? Was it?
It was over water.
It was.
Yeah. So the likelihood of it being found is slimmer, but you never know. I mean, they're still finding. I mean, what, they just find Marge?
Yeah.
Just a little while ago. So
anything's possible.
It is.
So yeah, and as far as we're aware, it's probably safe to assume that his name is listed on the Wall of the Missing at Pearl Harbor or on Oahu in Hawaii. So if you're ever out there, be sure to look up Cecil J. Doyle of the U.S. Marine Corps.
Yeah.
So now we will shift our focus into covering the history of VMF 121. This is a very extensive history.
It is.
I know when we were researching this, that Marine Corps squadron they're still around, and I think they've seen action in every major engagement that the United States has been in, really since World War II.
Yep.
They a very distinguished unit, and we're honored to cover them here. So they were initially formed on June 24th, 1941. Flying F-4F Grumman Wildcats. So the same plane that Doyle was flying when he was flying with the Cactus Air Force. And then they were one of the first squadrons assigned to the famous Cactus Air Force and arrived at Henderson Field in October of 1942. And I know you had mentioned it when we were talking about the gauntlet that the Tokyo Express had to run, but I think you had mentioned it. There weren't just fighters stationed at Henderson Field. What else would have been there besides?
You would have seen SBD Dauntlesses. You would have seen TBF Avengers, and then once in a while you'd see C-47s coming in and out. Transport VIP aircraft. We talked about it with Register. Chester Nimitz visited to deliver Register a Navy Cross. So you would have seen a lot of that, eventually B-17s when they lengthened it, but P-39s.
And those long-range ones probably would have been coming from Australia?
Most likely, Townsville and Darwin, some of the northern bases.
I know there's a famous picture of a C-40, or excuse me, an SBD. It literally looks like it was just smashed by a sledgehammer, but I think it was a direct impact from a Japanese bomb.
Right.
Really, really powerful picture. And then in 1943, the squadron transitioned from F-4F Wildcats to F-4U Corsairs, and then moved on to bases on Bougainville and Turtle Bay. Excuse me. They moved to Peleliu in 1944 and were based there until July of 1945, and returned home after the war, and were eventually deactivated on September 9th of 1945.
And that's it.
Yeah. If that's where we were ending off, we would be doing a major injustice to the squadron. During the war, VMF 121 destroyed 208 enemy aircraft and produced 14 fighter aces, which is the most of any Marine Corps squadron during World War II. A very incredible feat. Joe Foss was a member of VMF 121. So, you know, one day we will cover South Dakota aces, and obviously, he will be mentioned there. They are reactivated at Naval Air Station Glenview post-war and redesignated as VMA 121, which is Marine Attack Squadron 121. And while there, they continued to fly F-4U Corsairs before transitioning to F-8F Bearcats and then A-1 Sky Raiders. They flew the early designation of the Sky Raider, the 82s, from, excuse my pronunciation,
Pyeongtaek
in the Republic of Korea, starting in October 1951 for ground support operations. You know, we had a Sky Raider, a Vietnam-era Sky Raider at the Fargo Air Show this year. Those are huge.
Massive. Planes.
They are monsters. Oh my gosh. I never get tired of them. I'm a big guy myself. I've said it before. I have a soft spot for the P-47s, the Hellcats, and the Sky Raiders, but wow.
I've seen one next to a Corsair, and a Corsair is
They're big.
Yeah, it dwarfs.
Yeah.
Dwarfs the Corsair.
They are big planes. So continuing the legacy of, you know, the most fighter aces during World War II, VMA 121 dropped more tonnage of bombs than any other United States Marine Corps or U.S. Navy squadron during the Korean War. So again, right in the thick of the fight, never backing down, just, you know, what you expect from a Marine attack squadron. They relocated to Marine Corps Air Station El Toro in 1957 and were equipped with the very famous Grumman F9F Cougar.
And something to note here, I kind of left it out of our notes just because the squadron history is so long. The Cougar was actually with the lab system, with the nuclear bomb delivery system that I'm sure you're very well versed with the Sabre learning about. It was something a little interesting during that time frame.
You know, I actually had no idea that the Navy or Marine Corps practiced that.
Until this, I didn't. I went down a rabbit hole. So the research took a little longer.
Very good, Sam. Yeah. I like hearing rabbit holes. So they were, again, flying the F9F Cougars, which... Those were swept wing, correct?
Yes.
They were. Yeah, because the Panther had the straight wings, Cougars had the swept wings. Got it. Selfless plug, Cougar, go see it in Brainerd, Minnesota.
We need to as well.
Very cool airplane.
For the podcast.
Yeah, so. Very cool airplane. So, excuse me, VMA 121 was re-equipped with brand new, at the time, A4 Skyhawks. And then bounced around between various Marine Corps air stations and naval air stations as well. Pretty busy in the late 1950s and early 1960s before the war in Southeast Asia picked up.
Right.
We should mention that they were deployed to Naval Air Station Cecil Field in 1962 in response to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then with the Vietnam War ramping up, they began operations out of Chu Lai Air Base in South Vietnam, equipped with A-4E Skyhawks in December of 1966. Wow, they are a busy squadron.
Busy, and there's still more to go.
Yeah, it's not over. So they were redesignated as Marine Corps Attack Squadron All-Weather 121, or VMA, in parentheses, AW 121, in 1969, equipped with another famous Grumman design, the A6 Intruder. Personally, I love the Intruder.
It's cool.
It looks like, I remember as a kid, it looked like a bug, so I was kind of turned off on it, but as I've gotten older, it's like, it was a workhorse.
Oh yeah.
Electronic warfare platform, a bomber.
Doesn't need to look pretty.
It doesn't. It's like the A-10. Doesn't need to look pretty, but it gets the job done.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I guess I'll take over. Might be out of
my
breath.
My voice is hurting.
Might need a drink of water there. Later on, in 1989, in December 1989, they were redesignated VMFA All-Weather 121. And became the first Marine night attack squadron to be equipped with the McDonnell Douglas FA-18D Hornet. So moving kind of into one of the more modern jets of the day. They were deployed for Operation Desert Storm shortly after they were equipped with the Hornets. And they were flying they flew 557 sorties and 1,655.5 combat hours during Operation Desert Storm, which is the most out of any U.S. Marine Corps or U.S. Navy squadron.
That is unbelievable. Desert Storm was not that long.
No.
So they
1,600
were
hours.
Around the clock.
That's a lot of days.
That is a lot of days. If I was better at math, I could tell
you. Yeah, me too. That's why we're doing history. So that's three different times where it's been the most. Most aces, most tonnage during Korea, and now this. It's crazy.
Great squadron.
And they were deployed multiple times in the Middle East as a part of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, not to mention deployed to many other places in the Central Asia, Middle East during that time frame. And then in 2012, this is kind of the last tidbit here, they're transitioned to F-35Bs, and they were actually the first F-35 squadron across any service, across any country.
Really?
Yep, and they're still flying them today.
A Marine Corps squadron?
Yes.
Wow, you know, it's commonly said that the Marine Corps usually gets hand-me-down equipment from you know, the Navy, but the fact that they were the first to receive the state-of-the-art aircraft that the F-35 is, I think that's a testament to the legacy of that squadron.
Exactly.
And what they've done in their military service. And safe to assume they're still flying the 35s today?
Yes, they still are.
Wow. So, awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So now we have reached our third and final segment of the evening. Ignore the tennis ball being bounced on the ground.
He's wanting some playtime, which we'll give him.
Absolutely. So now we move on to surviving aircraft. And in the past, we've mentioned that World War II Navy and Marine aircraft didn't have denoting features for squadrons quite like the U.S. Army Air Force right. did. Obviously, we're all familiar with like the Blue Nose Bastards, the Botany, and all that fun stuff. But the Marines and Navy just didn't...
They lost their color in 1941.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. I'm a big Yellow Wings nerd, so some other day.
He is playing it lightly. He is the biggest Yellow Wing nerd I've ever met in my entire life. He's giving me the stink eye right now. So surviving aircraft... there's none in particular that are marked as Doyle's Wildcat. With that being said, though, an F4F3 bureau number 12296 is on display at the Pacific Aviation Museum at Ford Island in Hawaii. Coincidentally, I think right across the bay from Pearl yep. Harbor. And it is marked as just an inconspicuous Guadalcanal Wildcat.
Yeah, it's all a diorama. I don't know if you saw pictures of that.
I think with like the guys rearming it and whatnot.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
So. You know, it could fit the bill for any one of those pilots' planes. They didn't fly, they didn't have one in particular name to them. They might have had their name on it, but, you know, like as the case with the Army Air Force, they flew whatever plane was available.
Right.
So, and then a second is, again, an F4F4, bureau number 11828, and that is on display at the San Diego Air and Space Museum. Oh. And it is marked as a VMF-223 bird named to Marion E. Carl, an 18.5 victory ace, who flew during Midway and Guadalcanal. So, again, another Marine Corps ace racking up the kills. Pretty cool. I should mention, an honorable mention goes to the South Dakota Air National Guard's F-16C, mm-hmm. Forgive me, I'm usually so good at tail numbers, but they, for 2022, they had an F-16 painted up as Joe Foss's Viper, or excuse me, I bet Joe Foss wish he had a Viper in the Pacific, as his Wildcat.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know if there's ever been a U.S. Air Force plane that has received Marine Corps markings.
No, haven't heard of it.
Yeah. And in that same vein, again, another South Dakota plane was one of the Ellsworth-based B-1s, had the USS Midway on the tail. And I think that is the first time that a Navy ship has ever been put onto an Air Force plane. So,
almost reminds me of the picture of the Banshee, F-2H Banshee, landing. Must be Air
Force. Yeah. When it landed on the wrong carrier.
Exactly. And then something else to note, there was actually a ship, a destroyer escort ship named after Doyle.
Really?
The USS Cecil J. Doyle was a Butler-class destroyer that was laid down in 1944 and was launched later that year and commissioned. And it was only around for 2 years until it was decommissioned in 1946 and then was stricken off charge in 1967 after it sunk as a target. But it was a really cool homage to Cecil.
Absolutely.
And there's a whole Wikipedia page. It's actually, he doesn't have his own Wikipedia page, but if you're into ships, we won't call them boats here. We'll do it right.
Absolutely.
There's a whole Wikipedia page and write up on it, and it does discuss him a little bit, but it discusses how he, you know, is a posthumous awardee of the Navy Cross as well. So
does it say who christened the ship?
It does not, but...
probably safe to assume his mother or wife. I don't think it said anywhere if he was married or not. But
no, it didn't. And he, the boat or the ship, just said don't call it a boat, was kind of all over It was the first ship to actually reach the survivors of the USS Indianapolis.
Really?
The if those of you who don't know what the USS Indianapolis is, there's a movie about it.
Yeah.
It was the ship that actually delivered the atomic
components for the atomic bomb.
And it was sank on the way back. Just think what would have happened.
Oh my gosh.
I think about it a lot.
Yeah. That
it's my Roman Empire thought.
Absolutely. Wow, this episode has had a good mix of everything. John
We said it wasn't going to be long.
I know. We thought that this was literally going to be like a 10-minute one. What are we at right now?
30 minutes. So
I almost had a curse word.
So awesome. there's a lot to it. So, yeah, even though we couldn't track down specifics to the ace, there's a lot of context to him. And
absolutely.
I mean, there's a whole ship dedicated to him.
Absolutely.
So...
Well, thank you guys for tuning into this week's episode. Next week, is that the one
the one you're really looking forward to. They're all fun here, but
of course.
He's been planning this one for 4 weeks.
You have no idea how excited I am.
I've never seen someone so excited for Halloween.
So. I'm very excited for you guys to learn more, because this will be a first aircraft type for the podcast.
Exactly.
I don't think we've ever mentioned this type before. I'll tell you what, on the comments for this video or for this, when you listen to it, leave a comment for what aircraft you think we're going to be covering. And if you get it right, we will direct message you and I will send you, I'll send you 5 Planes on the Prairie stickers out of my own heart and will and whatever.
You're so nice, man.
I'm a man of the people. All right, you heard that there. Guess the aircraft if you made it this far, and if you get it right, we will send you some stickers.
We're counting on the Air Corps guys here.
Yeah. Which we gave them a shout. Yeah,
yeah,
we did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you guys again if you guys are listening.
We'll probably shout them out every time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, that kind of wraps it up for us this week. Any final thoughts?
No, this one was a lot of fun to research. I got back down into my Guadalcanal groove.
Yeah.
If you guys need any Guadalcanal books, recommendations, there's plenty. Joe Foss's Proud American. There's the South Pacific Air War series, which covers the lead up to Guadalcanal. And then there's the Solomon's Air War. Both of those are available on Amazon. Not sponsored by them. Would love to be. But they provide some really, really deep, in-depth books. And if you like digital art and all that stuff, there's some pretty cool photos and profiles of these. And a whole host of lost records on it, too.
Absolutely. All right, gang. Thank you again for tuning in. And until next time, we'll catch you later.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.